Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox here at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. Right now, I'm speaking to you from Eureka Springs, Arkansas, which is my fourth stop on my Miss America book tour. When this airs on Sunday the first time, I'll be in Kansas City, Missouri. I was just in three cities in New Mexico, and the message of the book, which is creating community to overcome the oppressions of the robber class and surviving and thriving through the upcoming robber class depression, has been enthusiastically received everywhere I've gone, and the hospitality everywhere has been so warm. Today, I'm so excited to be chatting with John Perkins here at Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm one of John Perkins' biggest groupies. He wrote Confessions of an Economic Hitman. It was a book that really changed my life fundamentally. After the break, I'll have the privilege of interviewing him. This is Cindy Sheehan. You're listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. We'll be right back after the break. Stay tuned.
My name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy, and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you are listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.CindySheehanSoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.CindySheehanSoapbox.com.
Robber class will never send their own children to fight and die. The robber class will never use their own money to pay for the wars. They want us to finance their wars, and they want us to give our children so they can be killed in their wars so they can profit. And we can never, ever give up.
Find the cost of freedom. Buried in the ground, Mother Earth will swallow you, lay your body down. Find the cost of freedom.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox here at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. Like I promised you before the break, we have a very special guest today, one a hero of mine for his courage and for his ability to communicate. And it was just a few months after my son Casey was killed in Iraq, and I was listening to a radio interview. And it was John Perkins, and he was on the radio, I think, for it was a long interview for like 3 hours. I believe it was on Coast to Coast with either Art Bell or George Norrie. I don't remember who was the interviewer. But I heard that interview. I couldn't sleep. I listened to the entire interview. Remember, my son had only been dead for a couple months. I was trying to put together the pieces and connect the dots. And so the next day I went out and bought John's book, Confession of an Economic Hitman, and it really cleared up a lot of questions I had. And I recommend John's books wherever I go for people to get an understanding about what our country really is about and what our country really does. Welcome to the show, John. I'm just so grateful that you're here today.
Well, thank you, Cindy. It's my pleasure to be on the show. You, likewise, are one of my heroes, so it's a mutual appreciation thing here.
Oh, and I know you're really busy, so I'm glad you took time. But you had the book Confessions of an Economic Hitman. It was forever on the New York Times bestseller list. And then you wrote another book called The Secret History of the American Empire, which I also read, and it was just super interesting. But some of my listeners who might not know your work, most of my listeners are very well-informed and very sophisticated, but can you tell them what an economic hitman is, just very briefly, so we can get into these other interesting questions?
Well, sure, Cindy. I think it's fair to say that we've created the world's first truly global empire, and economic hitmen work many ways to make this happen, but perhaps the most common is that we will identify a third world country that has resources our corporations covet, like oil, and then arrange a huge loan to that country from the World Bank or one of its sisters, but the money doesn't go to the country. Instead, it goes to our own corporations to build big infrastructure projects in the country, power plants and industrial parts, things that help a few very wealthy families in those countries, as well as our own corporations, but not the majority of the people who don't have enough money to buy electricity or don't have the skills to get jobs in industrial parks. And yet the whole country, is left holding this huge debt that it can't repay. And so at some point we go back and say, listen, since you can't repay your debts, give us a pound of flesh, sell your oil real cheap to our oil companies, or send troops in support of ours to someplace in the world like Iraq, or vote with us on the next United Nations vote. And in the few instances when we fail, then the jackals go in, and these are people that will assassinate or overthrow the leaders who have not gone along with what the economic hitmen were proposing. And so I think it's fair to say in that way we've managed to create this world's first truly global empire, and primarily without the military, and primarily in secret. Most people living in the United States don't realize that this is a key to our foreign policy.
And you, in your books, you give many illustrations about when this has happened. Can you just give a brief illustration to my listeners about one time that this strategy has been used?
Well, yeah, I talk about how I did it in Indonesia back in the 70s when we really wanted Indonesian oil. Also in many South American countries and African countries. I also talk about how I failed in Ecuador with Jaime Roldos, the president of Ecuador, and with Omar Torrijos of Panama. And because I failed, because those men wouldn't allow themselves to be corrupted, they wouldn't go along with the economic hitman game. They were both assassinated by CIA-sponsored jackals. But we're usually very successful. Nigeria, Congo, name it, almost any country in the world that has resources that we really want, whether it's coltan in Congo, which is in practically all of our computers and cell phones, or oil, of course, is the big one, or diamonds, or sometimes it's just cheap labor markets like in Haiti. Whenever you have a situation like that, you find economic hitmen there corrupting local officials and getting them to put their countries into a position where they're totally subservient to us in one way or another.
Well, I hope we get a chance to talk about Hugo Chavez and, you know, how he's avoided that similar fate, because, you know, I have met with President Chavez, and I admire what he's trying to do in his country, but he's up against a lot of odds, that's for sure. But was one of the first times that strategy was successful, was that in Iran in the 50s with Mossadegh?
Yes, that was really the first economic hitman hit. Early 50s, Iran had just democratically elected this president, Mossadegh, and he was Time Magazine's Man of the Year. He was held out as the hope for democracy around the world. But he insisted that the oil companies, the international oil companies, give a much larger share of the profits back to the Iranian people, or he threatened to nationalize them. We didn't like that. So we wanted to take him out, despite the fact he was democratically elected. But at the time, the Cold War was very hot, and Russia had nuclear weapons, as did we. We were afraid of a nuclear war, and Iran's right on the border with the Soviet Union. So we didn't really dare send in the troops, so we decided to try something different, send in a CIA agent named Kermit Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt's grandson.
Right.
And Kermit Roosevelt, with a few million dollars, managed to foment what looked like a massive strike. And it was actually not a lot of people, but he spent a lot of money hiring people to make it look like the whole country was up in arms against Mossadegh, which wasn't true at all. But he did manage to stage a coup and overthrow this democratically elected president and replace him with the Shah, who we all now know was a despot and a very good friend of Big Oil. The CIA looked at this, the State Department looked at this, and said, my gosh, you know, that was easy. It was cheap. A few million dollars. We didn't have to risk war. We didn't have to send in any troops. And nobody really knows what happened, that the United States was behind this. So it really opened the door to a whole new approach to international diplomacy. The one problem in that case was that Roosevelt was a card-carrying CIA agent. Had he been apprehended, it would have been extremely embarrassing for the government, the U.S. government. So the decision was made shortly after that to use independent consultants, people who worked for big consulting firms like me. I never actually worked for the government, never directly employed by the CIA. I worked for a big international consulting firm, and we had contracts with the State Department or USAID or the World Bank or other such organizations.
That brings up a question to me. Why do sometimes we use troops and sometimes we use the economic hitman way? Is that because we try to use the economic hitman way and it doesn't work? Like, for example, Iraq, why do we have thousands, you know, hundreds of thousands of troops have gone through there and now, you know, tens of thousands still over there and many people, including my son, have died. And we're increasing troop strength to Afghanistan. Why was an economic hitman approach not used, or was it used and they just failed?
Well, in the case of Iraq, yes, we had a huge success in Saudi Arabia, which I talk about in the book. I won't go into that right now unless you want me to, but it was probably one of the biggest deals of the century after the OPEC oil embargoes of the 70s, where the economic hitmen went in and brought the House of Saud around in a big way. And we decided after that we should do something similar with Saddam Hussein, but he wouldn't buy. And I've never really understood why he wouldn't, because if he had, he'd still be running the country.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't buy. And so we tried to take him out with the jackals, but he had very, very good security forces. He had a lot of lookalike doubles, and it's hard to take out a man. Because you always have to get security forces involved if you're going to assassinate a leader. There has to be somebody in the system who's compromised.
Right.
And if you've got the lookalike double and your own security people don't know who they're guarding, it makes it very difficult. And he was very sharp. So we sent in the troops in 91, took out his military, figured he'd be sufficiently chastised at that point that the economic hitmen could get through to him in the 90s. They couldn't. He still didn't come around, and neither could the jackals get through to him. So we sent the military in. So in that case, yes, all else failed. When in the military is the final solution, if the jackals fail and the economic hitmen fail. There have been other times, like when we sent the troops into Panama in 89 to take out Noriega,
right.
That is a little bit more mysterious. But those often serve as an example. So in 89, we were trying to scare Saddam Hussein, and one way to do that was to bomb Panama City and kill something between 2,000 and 6,000 innocent civilians and take out Noriega. It was a scare tactic, not just for Saddam Hussein, but for several other leaders in Latin America. So sometimes a show of force is done just to prove that we can do that and we're willing to do it. And I think that's been particularly the case under both of the Bush presidencies.
So it's a message too. It's not just not just for the people of that country or their leaders of that country, but it sends a message to other leaders too.
I think so. My experience has been more that it's done as a last resort. But I think I think this is and what we're seeing now with all the information that's coming out on the torturing under the Bush administration, it's beginning to appear more and more like to a certain degree there were a lot of people in that administration that were just pretty violent, gun happy people that were willing to torture. And swinging a heavy stick.
This is Cindy Sheehan. You're listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, and we're talking to former economic hitman John Perkins, who courageously has written and exposed what our country does around the world for our corporations, for profit, to control other people's resources. John, back a few minutes ago in the conversation, you said that the United States is history's first truly global empire. What do you mean by that, and why weren't other empires, for example, the Roman Empire or the British Empire, consider them truly global empires?
Well, because I didn't truly impact every country on the planet. You know, of course, in the Roman times, they didn't know that the world was round. They didn't know we had a globe out there. They didn't know half the world existed, or a lot more than half the world. And in the case of the British, they didn't reach into Latin America in any significant way. But this particular empire does reach every corner of the planet. And it really isn't an American empire anymore. It's a corporate empire. It's run by big corporations. The countries have become a little irrelevant. It's sort of like the time when city-states became nations, except today the nations are becoming irrelevant. You know, we used to view the world as this big globe with 180-some-odd countries, of which a few had a lot of power, like the Soviet Union and the United Kingdom and the United States at various times. But today, I think a better vision of the world, geopolitics, would be big clouds that sweep around the whole planet. They don't know national borders. They don't listen to any particular sets of laws. These are the big multinational corporations, and they strike deals with the Chinese and the Taiwanese, with the Israelis and the Arab nations, with whoever they please, whoever has the resources that they covet or the markets that they covet. And they really are calling the shots today. Nobody gets elected in Washington anymore without a lot of money, and most of the money comes from big corporations. The lobbyists have really called a lot of the shots in Washington, and they're at the beck and call of the big corporations. And the big corporations control our mainstream media. So they are truly the new emperor. So it's really not so much an American empire, although most of these corporations are headquartered in the United States. But the empire really is bigger than that today. It's a corporatocracy is the modern equivalent of the old emperor.
I love that. It was the first time in your book that I heard that term, corporatocracy, and that really says it, that, you know, that explains it all. But if it's an empire and you say that the corporations are the emperors, is that mean that there's not like just one emperor we can focus on, but it's a multi-international global, like it's like a hydra with many heads, or...
It is, and this isn't a conspiracy theory. These people don't get together and smoke-filled rooms secretly and conspire to do illegal activities. You know, the president of Exxon does not have to meet with the president of Monsanto or Nike to make this thing work. But they all know that they have one goal in common. They all have one single goal, and that is to maximize profits regardless of the social and environmental costs. And they all pretty much know what they got to do to make that happen. And so they do work very much in unison, but not necessarily in official collaboration. You know, and I think that satisfying this one goal has created a very unstable and dangerous world, as we're all seeing today. And it's also it's a world where less than 5% of the world's population live here in the United States and consume more than 25% of our resources, and yet where roughly half the world's population lives in dire poverty. It's not a model that you can hold out as a success. It's a failure. You can't pass that model on to China or India or Africa or Latin America. You know, you'd literally need at least five other planets just like this one with all the same resources with no people on it in order to pass that model on to the rest of the world. So the one thing that we know is that it's an unsuccessful, a failed model, even though we like to say it's the best one history's ever come up with. It is not. And I think what that tells us, Cindy, more than anything, is we have to change. We cannot continue along this path. We've got to change this model. And I think really there's a lot of hope here because it is the first empire that's been built primarily without the military, through economics. And in fact, there's a voting booth out there which is called the marketplace. It's very democratic if we choose to make it that. If none of us ever again buys from Nike and we write Nike a letter and say we're not buying from you because you have sweatshops And we write a letter to Patagonia and say, we are buying from you because you don't have sweatshops. Well, Nike will either have to change its ways or close its doors. And we need to really understand that, how we have changed corporations in the past. We got them to clean up terribly polluted rivers, to open their doors wider to women and minorities, to get rid of aerosol cans, on and on. There's a lot of specific things. Now it's time to turn it up a notch and say, you must change your basic goal. You can create profits, but you must do it within the context of creating a sustainable, just, and peaceful world. No more profits, regardless of social and environmental costs. Let's turn that around.
Well, my contention, I just published a new internet booklet called Myth America, 10 Greatest Myths of the Robber Class and the Case for Revolution. And my contention is that we can't change the robber class. We have to change ourselves, the robbed class. I say there's only one division in this country and in the world. It's the robber class and the robbed class. Mm-hmm. And we have to change ourselves to create sustainable economies and a sustainable environment. But my first chapter, the first myth that I expose is, you know, America is the greatest nation in the universe. And I'm sure you get these people telling you that you're un-American, that you're not patriotic, that you hate America or whatever, blah, 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 like I do. But if we have an empire is a hard concept for people to grasp. They do think of military empires, and as a matter of fact, we are a military empire because we have 800-some-odd bases around the world that can enforce this corporate colonialism that you talk about. But if we have an empire, isn't it a good one? And is it a benevolent empire, as some people tell me?
It's anything but benevolent. It's a terribly sadistic, aggressive, and mean empire. And I'm ashamed to say that I am a very loyal American. I'm related to Tom Paine, and I have ancestors who fought in the American Revolution in every war since then and until this one. And I want to see us change, because what we're doing out there, and most Americans don't realize this, is we're doing something that's totally contrary to our most sacred documents, to our beliefs. I mean, we're truly seeing that now in all the information that's coming out about the tortures, and we're beginning to understand how we've totally gone against our principles, and I think that's horrifying to most Americans. I think most of us want to believe that we do the right thing, and the information has been kept from us, and we have to take a lot of responsibility for accepting the false information, too. It's made life easier for us to be able to just accept that. So we really need to turn this around and to understand we are anything but a benign empire. We are a very malicious empire run by corporate heads who many of them are sociopaths. Let's face it. I mean, there's a lot of people in our corporations who are very good people, and they are the key to turning this around. And some of them are in very high positions. Some of our corporate CEOs are very fine people who have children and grandchildren. They want to create a better world for those people. We also have some that are very psychopathic or sociopathic. They really don't give a damn. But what they do give a damn about is that we buy their goods and services, that we support the economy that allows them to have this power. And that's where our pressure point is. That's where we have leverage, that we don't have to do that. It's up to us to make that decision.
Well, I fully agree with you. We're talking to John Perkins here at Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. We have to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be back with John. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Hi, my name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy, and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you are listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.cindysheehansoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.cindysheehansoapbox.com.
If we're tired of war, if we're tired of protesting, if we're tired of coming out here, rain or shine, we still have to keep moving. We cannot give up. And we have to move through our disappointment. We have to move through our fatigue. We have to move through our anger. I was telling the grannies, I'm a granny now. I have a 10-month-old grandson. And I have one on the way. But I'm beyond raging. Whatever that is above raging, I'm raging, I'm pissed off, I'm words that I can't say on a microphone when there's kids here. But that's the way we all have to be.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox here at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. We're having a very fascinating chat with former economic hitman John Perkins. Well, John, it looks like we do have time to talk about President Hugo Chavez. President Chavez has been demonized in our media, as you well know. He's been called a dictator, a communist. I was, quick story here, I don't want to take up too much time. But I was on Hardball one time, and Nora O'Donnell was substituting, and she introduced me as someone who met with communist dictator Hugo Chavez. And we had a quick break, and I said, Nora, he's not a communist, nor is he a dictator. He's been democratically elected. And she said, well, we had a discussion, but we decided to call him a communistic dictator. And he's not a communist. He's a socialist. He's trying to build a, you know, a socialist republic there in Venezuela, but that just shows how the media can manipulate our senses, you know, the way we think and the way Americans think. Even people on the left criticized me for meeting with Hugo Chavez. But you've spent a lot of time in Latin America, and you've talked about the dictators that you failed with and who were assassinated by the jackals. But what's the significance of President Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, and what's he trying to do in Latin America?
Well, Chavez has changed history. There's no question about it, and he is democratically elected. It's disgusting to me when USA Today or other newspapers and magazines refer to him as a dictator. It's just a pure lie. We've now got 10 countries in Latin America representing more than 80% of the population of South America who voted in this new wave of presidents. And these are presidents, and they've done it democratically, and these are all presidents who, they're very different from each other in many ways, but in one way or another, they've all said, our resources have to go to help our people. Bolivia's gas must profit Bolivia's people. Ecuador's oil must profit Ecuador's people. This is an amazing revolution that's occurred. And every one of these countries during most of my lifetime was ruled by a series of brutal dictators, primarily puppets of U.S. corporations and the U.S. government. Suddenly all that's changed. And it's changed because Chavez got into power in 98, and he was not at all anti-American at the time at all. In many respects, George Bush pushed him into saying some pretty vitriolic things. He's still not anti-American. He waves around our Declaration of Independence and loves our principles. He just doesn't like the way we treat his country and many others. We tried to overthrow him in 2002, a CIA coup. He withstood it, was out of office for roughly 40 hours, and then got back in. And because of that, it really opened the door to these other countries or these other presidents to come in. So today you've got a remarkable president like Rafael Correa of Ecuador, who's kind of a personal friend, and, and, and has come up with a new constitution, has a PhD in economics from the University of Indiana. You cannot in any way call him a non-capitalist. He's trained as a capitalist. He understands and speaks our language. You've got two pretty amazing women presidents, Chile and Argentina.
Right.
Just a whole group of these presidents that are suddenly standing up to the corporatocracy. It's a true revolution that started south of the border. And I think you can say that we saw it spread here to a certain degree during the last elections. I mean, who knows where Obama's going now? And certainly a lot of people who voted for him, as I travel around the country, are expressing disappointment in what he's doing. But it's really too early to say. But the fact of the matter is, when we voted, we did something pretty radical. My books are in about 40 languages, and I get emails from all over. And after that election, people from all over the world bombarded me with emails saying, what an amazing country that you could go from an extremely conservative Texas oil man white guy to a very liberal Illinois African-American. And of course, a lot of people around the world predicted that Bush would not allow Obama to take the White House, that there would be something would happen. And it didn't. There was a smooth transition. So something very remarkable happened here. But I think we, Cindy, must understand that the president can't do a lot. We have to do it. Slavery didn't end because Abraham Lincoln found himself in the White House. Abraham Lincoln got in the White House because we, the people, wanted to end slavery. And women didn't get the right to vote because Woodrow Wilson ran on a right to vote for women platform. He did not. Women got the right to vote because they demonstrated tremendously against Woodrow Wilson and embarrassed the hell out of him. And finally, he pushed it through. We didn't get out of Vietnam because Richard Nixon was anti-war. He was not. We got out of Vietnam because we took to the streets and convinced Nixon that he had to get us out of Vietnam. It's always we, the people. We must do this now. We've got a president in there that is open to a lot of things that the former administration was not. But we, the people, must push. And we must push the corporations who control the purse strings behind all of our politicians.
Well, I have a question, and I totally agree with you. Everything has to be grassroots. It has to come from the bottom up, because I don't think anything, relevant or positive has, for us, has come from the top down. But, we talked about the empire, Afghanistan. Afghanistan is a place that has been the burial place of many an empire. Most recently, the USSR military. Empire, and we know the USSR overspent on weapon systems and their military-industrial complex. They had a decade-long, they got mired down in Afghanistan. Now Barack Obama, with his neoconservative foreign policy team of Hillary Clinton and Robert Gates, who was, George Bush's Secretary of Defense, they're sending more troops to Afghanistan. People, I get emails from all over the world, too, and people tell me, Cindy, you should tell Barack Obama that that's a big mistake to send more troops to Afghanistan and to spend more of our resources and our children's lives in Afghanistan, killing more people of Afghanistan. And I just reply back, Barack Obama knows full well that sending more troops to Afghanistan is a mistake. Why do you think that we're making that mistake?
Well, it's pure speculation on my part, Cindy, which I don't really like to do. I like to talk about things that I know about, like economic hitmen and corporations.
Uh-huh.
But what I do know about is that assassination is always an issue. And we've had, in my lifetime, a president assassinated, one physically, Kennedy, and another one was assassinated character-wise, that was Bill Clinton. There's always that out there, and I think we've seen candidates like John Dean go down with character assassination. It's a very dangerous business out there, and I don't know what kind of pressures Barack Obama has put upon him, but I do know that he has stood up to the CIA. He's also bent to them just very recently, and he has brought out these memos. He's doing some very courageous things, but I suspect he realizes that he has to make certain compromises just to stay in office. I'm seeing Rafael Correa, who is a hero of mine, the president of Ecuador, making some concessions recently to some of the mining companies. Also, he's not making the concessions to the oil companies, but he is to some of the other mining companies, probably for the same reason, that's my guess, because all of these people know that if something happens to them, whether it's a coup in Ecuador or an assassination in Washington, which is a possibility, we have to understand that, then it changes everything for a very long time. The next people that come into power are real puppets at that point. And I think we have to be aware of that, and that Barack Obama is a student of history. He's very aware of that. And so it once again comes back to we the people. We must put more pressure not to go any further in Afghanistan to pull out the troops. I mean, we learned in Vietnam that when you pull out the troops, it doesn't mean the end of the... Vietnam is now a capitalist country, which right. It probably never would have been if we'd stayed there. And yes, you're right. Afghanistan brought down the Soviet Union to a very large degree. It's going to bring us down, too. It's going to bring Obama down. It's a terrible mistake, what we're doing there. But we, the people, must be the ones, just as we had to be in Vietnam, to demand an end to this and not look to Obama to just be able to do it on his own, because I think he's dealing with some very powerful and very dangerous forces.
Well, unfortunately, many of the anti-war movement groups have, opted out of pressuring Barack Obama, and I agree with you that it doesn't matter who's president. We, the people, can't abdicate our responsibility to our country or to the world. Do you feel comfortable talking about Haiti?
Haiti. Yes, I'm
having a little bit of a hard time hearing
you, but yes,
but there's
Haiti,
something
yes.
I don't understand about Haiti. Is it seems to be a very poor, resource-less country. Why did we depose Aristide, and what was the threat that our government felt from Aristide in Haiti?
Well, it's quite simple, actually. I mean, nothing's all that simple. There's a long history of Haiti, including the money that France claims that Haiti owes them. But Haiti sets the bottom limit for minimum wages in the hemisphere. It's the poorest country that has the lowest minimum wages. No other country in the hemisphere, not El Salvador or Honduras or Bolivia or Ecuador, any other country, will ever allow itself to pay its workers less than Haiti. Aristide threatened to triple, double first, and then he was going to triple the minimum wage in Haiti. We had a lot of factories down there. Disney had factories where it made T-shirts, et cetera. We made baseballs and all kinds of things. We had factories in Haiti, and the people that ran those factories didn't want to see minimum wages increase. But more importantly, if Haiti had increased its minimum wages, every country in the hemisphere would have had to have done that, at least all the poorest ones, the ones where we have a lot of textile shops and a lot of other industries where we get cheap labor. Central America and some of the South American countries. So when Aristide threatened to do that, it was threatening a huge change all over the hemisphere. And that's a main reason why we took him out.
We have about 8 minutes left of the interview. And again, I really want to thank you for taking time to be on my show today. But what is the most important thing you think my listeners should know about your work, about what we need to do to roll our sleeves up to really do the work that needs to be done and create this grassroots community and for true change and true relevant change, not just for Americans, but...
Well, we have to keep getting the word out there. It's something you've done so effectively, Cindy, and it's been wonderful to watch how you've turned a terrible personal tragedy into a way to really make a difference in the world. I think we all need to learn from that, and we all need to step out and turn things around and speak out constantly. We're all teachers. We all need to be very conscious of how we shop, and not just not buy products from Nike that are made in sweatshops, but let Nike know. We've got to let them know. We can turn this thing around, but we have to do it. And it's important that we drop our cynicism. It's always good to question everybody and everything. But we've got to understand that we can do it. We've got to do it. We've done it in the past. We've made tremendous changes in the past. And it's time for us to really step out now and do it and to recognize how vulnerable these big corporations are that sometimes seem so powerful. But we've seen how vulnerable they are in the last few years. So many of them have gone belly up and gotten into big trouble. They are totally dependent on us for their very existence. And so it's very, very important that we understand the power that each one of us has and that we exercise that power. It's important how we vote on Election Day, but I think it's even more important how we vote every time we go to the supermarket, every time we buy a shirt or decide not to, or an appliance or a car or anything. That's an incredibly important voting booth, and we really need to understand that and use that voting booth more effectively.
And you're talking about people who make consumer goods for Americans, and very often the corporations that have the most power in our country aren't necessarily ones that we can boycott or write to and say, you know, write to Boeing and say we're not going to buy a jet from them. But, you know, what about the banks and Wall Street and everything that's happening in that kind of, you know, atmosphere right now? What can we as American citizens do to try and remove ourselves from that system or to change that system to make it better for us and not for the Wall Street banksters who, you know, they make a mistake, they get billions of dollars. We make a mistake, we lose our homes or our jobs.
Yeah, how much time do we have?
Yeah, I know, huh? We have about five
more
minutes.
A short answer to that is in the long run, we're going to need to change the system. I think our current currency system is a failure too, and that's a very long conversation. But in the short run, we all have choices of what banks we go to, and most of the small local banks have not done the things that the big banks are being accused of. They've been pretty had integrity throughout this. A lot of them. There's a lot of good bankers out there and good banks, and we need to support them more. But you know. We need to really create a new economy here, and you mentioned the military suppliers, Raytheon and Lockheed Martin and General Dynamics and so on. What if we insisted that a percentage of our current military budget would go to pay those same companies to, instead of making missiles and tanks and AK-47s, to create machinery that will clean up the terribly polluted lands of Nicaragua and every other country in the world that our corporations, our agribusinesses have gone in and polluted, and that we clean up polluted waters and air all over the world? What if we paid a percentage of our tax dollars to corporations like Monsanto to, instead of making GMOs, to create true systems where the starving people of the world can feed themselves and each other? That's where we need to go now. We need to recognize that if we want homeland security, we must look at the whole planet as our homeland. We need to understand that terrorism doesn't come from crazy thoughts, millions of crazy people around the world who just hate us. Terrorism comes because people are desperate, because they're starving, because they need to take care of their children, because their lands have been destroyed by oil companies or by Chiquita or Dole or by big hydroelectric plants. That's what creates terrorism. And a few fanatics like Osama bin Laden buy into that, and they use that as a way to get people to come to work for them. But right. The real way to get rid of that, the real way to get rid of the pirates of Somalia, are to stop destroying these countries. We've destroyed the fishing fleets of Somalia, basically, by pirating their fish, fishing fleets from Europe and even the United States, dumping toxic waste in their water. Our nuclear Navy fleet goes through that area as it thinks it's protecting the oil route, dumping nuclear waste in that area. This is what the Somalis accuse us of, and they've been complaining for 20 years. They've turned to piracy. If we want to stop piracy, let's go to the root cause. Let's go to the root cause of all of these problems around the world. In fact, that's what the new leaders in Latin America are in the process of doing. They're saying, we don't want violence in our countries. But we need to get to the root causes of where the violence comes from and change that. That's where we all need to go, Cindy.
Well, of course, I'm on board with you. And, John, I really want to thank you for your work. I know it's meant a lot to me, and I try to pass it on. And whenever I speak, I try to educate people because, like you said, it's all about education. Where can my listeners, do you have a website my listeners could go to?
Absolutely, johnperkins.org, very simple. And in there is listed places where I speak, and I'm traveling around the country doing a lot of speaking these days. I have a new book coming out in November, which addresses many of these topics. And if they go to my website, they'll know when that comes out.
Well, I'm looking forward to your new book. I've read all your books, and something people don't know about you, you're very spiritual, and you have a very spiritual orientation, a respect for the earth, and respect for all life, not just American life, which is something that we really need to teach people here in this country. John, thank you again for taking time out of writing your book to talk to us, and I hope when your new book is written and you're promoting it, you'll come back and share some more experiences with my listeners and me.
I'd love to, Cindy. Thank you, and thank you so much for all that you're doing. It's shows like this one and people like you speaking out all the time that are going to turn this around, and I know we are going to turn it around. You're doing
it. It was an honor for me to talk to you, John, and don't work too hard, and you're listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. We'll be right back with my Soapbox rant. Thank you again, John.
Thank you.
My name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy, and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you're listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.cindysheehansoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.cindysheehansoapbox.com.
You know, we have to use that. Anger. It can be a bad emotion, but it could also be a positive emotion. If you channel it to activism, and if you channel it to total righteous causes, peace is a righteous cause to be angry about. Not having peace is what we should be angry about. That peace is somehow used. Yo, they're just hippies. They're just peace activists. We don't have to pay attention to them. Like, somehow it's wrong for us not to want people to get killed. So use that anger and channel it to save the lives of our children. My rant today is about Robert Klass myth number 11. If you work hard enough and keep your nose clean, you too can become part of the Robert Klass. I've already done 14 events for my new e-booklet, Myth America, 10 Greatest Myths of the Robert Klass and the Case for Revolution. And today, like I said before, I'm here in Eureka Springs, Arkansas, for my 15th event tonight. At each event, there has been a very salient observation, which is one of the most insidious myths of the robber class is the one where anyone can become part of the robbers, because America is the, quote, land of opportunity, end quote, and our streets are paved with gold. It's true, some people have worked their way up from the robbed class to become a robber, but that's rare, and oftentimes these people have robbed and murdered to claw their way up to the robber class.
Of course, the robber class wants us to worship and envy them so we don't rebel against them and their crimes. But there are several things wrong with believing this myth here in the robbed class. First of all, this myth is simply not true. Like I said, some people, such as the Carnegies and the Kennedys, elevated themselves to the status of robber class by exploiting other people and committing outright crimes. However, immigrants who scrimped and saved and worked hard to escape the poverty and oppression of their countries came to America to find the same conditions, only oftentimes worse. The American dream was a nightmare of sweatshops, indentured servitude, child labor, and debt slavery to the company store. After a few generations, conditions may have improved, and some moved up to the robbed class divides of working class, lower middle class, or even middle class, but few attained robber class status. Secondly, the quote, "if you work hard and keep your nose clean," end quote, concept says to each person that we do not deserve basic human rights, that only if we attain robber class divinity, then we have the rights to good education for us and our children, good health care, healthy food, shelter, and other basic human rights. Somehow, by the accident of our birth, we feel wrongly that we are not entitled to these things. Are you effing kidding me? Remember, robbers are most often born to wealth and privilege, are groomed from a young age to be used by the robber class. Hello, fellow human being, wake up. You're entitled to those things now. Why should we have to lose our homes while the robber class lives in mansions and is becoming wealthy off the expansion and contraction of the housing bubble? Why should our children have to die in wars or go into lifelong debt to be able to go to college? Why should a busy working mother have to drive through McDonald's for so-called happy meals for her children because she can't afford healthy fresh food, nor can she afford the time to cook for her family? It's a waste of our time to go to the robber class politicians to demand such things as more money for education, or health care, or housing, or social programs, or whatever. And the robber class politicians tell us, we don't have any money. However, if Goldman Sachs or AIG goes to members of their own robber class and says, we need money so we don't have to lose any money paying for our own crimes and or mistakes, the robber class says back to them, how much do you need and will you take a check from the Federal Reserve? Thirdly, why would you want to be a robber anyway? You know damn well what it's like to struggle to make ends meet or to have good relationships and good health. If a few are wealthy, then many are poor. I'm not against wealth or comfort, but I am when it comes at the expense, health, or welfare of another human being. You cannot and should not want to become part of the robber class. We should all be comfortable and have access to good education, health care, and other human rights without exploiting the labor and lives of others. If we practice the suggestions at the end of my e-booklet that appear in the chapter, Conclusion Revolution, we will all become the Robin Hoods of our time, stealing from the robber class to keep our resources and wealth in the robbed class, instead of the way it's always been, stealing from the robbed to give to the robbers. You can go to CindySheehanSoapbox.com to order a copy of my e-booklet, Myth America, 10 Greatest Myths of the Robber Class and the Case for Revolution, for a minimum $10 donation to the soapbox. Your soapbox action for the day is to go to John Perkins' website and try to learn more about this economic hitman system that we have and the corporatocracy and how we can work together to resist that. Well, that's the end of the show. I'd like to thank from the bottom of my heart my guest, John Perkins, and I would also like to thank you for listening, as always, and my engineer, Scott Cuddy, and my webmaster, Rich Bowser. Don't forget to email me your questions or listener rants to Cindy@CindySheehanSoapbox.com. If you don't like what's happening in our world, what are you waiting for? Get off your ass and start a revolution. Bye. We'll talk to you next week.
I must make my witness. Have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad.
It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. Dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe, and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes. As if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
They're yelling in Baton Rouge.